Thanks for having me back on the show, Anton. It's great to be here.
Yeah, definitely. I think we are in very special times today, and I think it's a privilege to speak with you as the mad scientist of multifamily in particular. We both have been in this business for quite some time, so we have seen the ups and downs. And what we have seen over the last 2 months is only absolutely unbelievable, right? And I think a lot of people do not really understand the impact of what we have gone through over the last 2 months, because as it is always the case, the impact is always a little bit delayed. But I think it's important that everyone recognizes what all the involvement in particularly in interest rates have had just over the last 2 months, how that will impact everything going forward. So it's really great to have you here. So Neil, why don't you tell our audience a little bit more about yourself first, so that we have a good context of before we start the discussion.
Of course, I am a data scientist by profession, computer science degree. First and foremost, I'm a technology, so you can call me a geek, a nerd, a dork, all of those things sort of apply to what I do. And I have 800 investors who are themselves geeks and nerds. We use data science in a very unique and very advanced way to source our properties. Unlike most syndicators, I do not believe in investing in only one particular vertical. I invest in multifamily, in BTR, I do new construction, value add, storage, self-storage, industrial. I follow both the generic 10-year trends, and then I also follow the verticals that are doing better. And so I'm always happy to step away from any market or any city if I feel that that is becoming overloaded. So as a result, my portfolio of about $1 billion in assets under management is in 10 states. So I move around quite a bit. I follow the data. It's very painful to do so because it takes a year to set up new connections and contacts in a new city. But I feel that if I don't do that, then I'm not truly the mad scientist. You know, I have to follow where the data goes, and I have to be willing to leave a city that I have connections in and walk away from that. And I've done that a number of times already. And so to me, I think that what is fascinating about this industry is that you can use data, you can predict future things very strongly. And there's a lot of money to be made in that way. We have, we have some of the healthiest IRR rates in the entire industry. And that's happened because we've taken risks. Because today, I believe everyone is taking risks that they don't fully understand.
Yeah, I definitely agree with you on that. When we talk about how you're picking markets, can you give us a little bit more of a flavor how you approach this? I know we have gone through that discussion over a number of years, and you suddenly have shifted your position depending on what you have identified as new trends.
Sure.
And so it's only would be interesting what you have seen with COVID, happening, and where we are today, and where you see a shift in those trends.
Absolutely. I think that the market moves. Nothing stays perfect forever. No market, no city, no vertical stays, in the same place. So you'd really have to continuously adapt. And as you implied, I've changed my position on things a number of times. In general, I do not like new construction because of higher risk, but I've been forced to move to that because the risk on the value side, ad side, kept increasing, whereas the risk on the new construction side also increased, but at a slower rate. So at some point, the risk of value add and the risk of new construction was so close together that it made sense to look at new construction assets. So I build I do new constructions, but obviously because of the inherent risk of new construction, I like to add safety. And the way I add safety is when I'm doing new construction, I don't build multifamily. I build something that is more powerful than multifamily, something that has lower cap rates, and that is build to rent, which is essentially a new form of medium density apartment housing, where you're either building very small single families or you're building townhomes. So that low density nature of it is very appealing after COVID. So that is my safety mechanism, because the cap rates there are significantly lower than they are for multifamily. So that's one direction that I've taken. The other direction that I've taken, which I'm very pleased about, these today, I hear more people talking about it in podcasts. 2 or 3 years ago, I was getting bashed in other people, you know, talking about me saying these things. So it's nice that people have come to this conclusion. And that is that today, tertiary markets and even remote markets beyond tertiaries are actually smarter, stronger markets to invest in, right? I am now investing in markets with less than 100,000 people because I can buy a wonderful 80s brick property for $125,000-$130,000 a door. Now, of course, I only invest in a very select number of those markets that are not dependent on one type of job, because that can really be a killer. So the good news is there's a lot of markets under 100,000, so you have a lot to select from. So you can be very, very nitpicky and selective. And so I've been saying this for 4 or 5 years. My greatest successes have come from markets that no one has ever heard of. Dalton, Georgia, Idaho Falls, St. George, Utah. I mean, Durham, North Carolina. These are markets that nobody ever puts in a list, right? And I've always felt that these markets were stronger and they were the beneficiaries of their primary markets, which, you know, being overhot or overheated. And so that philosophy, I am basically doubling down or tripling down on, especially when it comes to the value add side, but even the new construction side. Currently, some of my biggest projects where I have the most amount of personal money invested are in Idaho Falls, a metro that only has 106,000 people. But the cool thing is Idaho Falls is one of the fastest growing cities in the entire country. And there are thousands of cities, right? So, you know, people say Austin's the fastest growing, and that's not right. Austin is in fact the fastest growing major city in America, right? So it's Austin and Phoenix. But the word major is very important. When we use data science, we have to be very careful about the way we say things. The truth is, no major city, no big city in America is ever the fastest growing, because big cities simply don't grow as fast as small ones. And so we are doubling down on this concept of true tertiary markets, hundreds of miles away from a secondary, or maybe thousands of miles away from a primary marketplace. That's our core belief today, and we are implementing on that core belief.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very good point, right? Obviously, not that our listeners get the wrong idea, right? Not all tertiary markets are good markets to be in.
They're mostly bad, actually. I'd say 80%, 90% bad. But the good news is there are so many of them that 10% is a very big number.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. I think also you mentioned BTR, right? Built to rent. You have started out in that segment several years ago.
Yeah, 3 years ago.
Yeah, 3 years ago. That was really pre-pandemic, right?
Yes. Yeah, a year before the pandemic.
And but it really started coming to the mainstream recognition through the pandemic. So you saw,
correct, because people wanted more, you know, lower density, right? So we were a year ahead, and we had already locked in a very large amount of land in a number of different cities. So Houston, San Antonio, Fredericksburg, Austin, New Braunfels, we'd locked in land for, you know, BTR and San Marcos. So we were very, very lucky because the land just went completely insane in prices. I mean, 2x, 3x, you know, for the land that we were buying.
Yeah. So you still like that Central Texas market with these cities you mentioned as one of the top markets for BTR?
Today it is unquestionably the top market for BTR. I think that it's bubbly like any other market. So I am taking defensive measures because now the cap rates are coming down, construction costs are going up. So I'm doing defensive measures. Half of my team today is in a conference in Phoenix and the other half is in a conference in San Antonio. And both conferences are modularization conferences. So they take two different approaches. One basically does industrial construction offsite. The other one does panelization. So we're looking at both approaches because we feel that even being in the best market in the US, there's just so much bubbliness in the market. There's so much inherent risk that we need to stay ahead. And if we can either do industrial construction, which essentially is building offsite and then assembling on site, or panelization, which basically means you do assemble on site, but you're bringing panels to the site and screwing them in. So you're not using trucks to, you know, bring a whole property, but you're bringing thousands of panels onto the site and basically you're screwing them in. So both of those approaches are radical. Both of those approaches make a lot of sense when construction costs are so high and labor costs are so, you know, labor is just not even available, right? So we're not even talking about cost at this point. We're talking about availability. And so for us to finish our projects on time and come in under cost, we are looking far and wide. So the short answer, Anton, is, and you asked me this question a moment ago. You said, you know, you still think that these are the best markets in the US. The answer is yes, but you have to do more today. You must do something different. You must do something unique. You must be willing to step out a little bit further into the abyss, because we are staring at that right now. The last 2 months have been the most radical in my career, short of, you know, April 2020 when COVID struck. 2 months, last 2 months have been amazing. And I am just shocked. I'm shocked. That I, when I listen to podcasts, people are not talking about this. They're just saying interest rates are going up. They're not going up. They've skyrocketed. And almost all of the product that's in the marketplace for value add, new construction is not affected yet. And I'll explain why it will get affected, but it takes an extra 2 or 3 months for new construction to get affected. So, you know, when you're looking at the value add component of the marketplace, we've seen some astonishing changes. So I think almost everything that's in contract is either going to fall out, or they're going to have to use absurdly low LTVs, or as you mentioned before we got started, people are going to have to sign recourse loans. So, and I don't think the market fully understands that.
Yeah. So it certainly should touch a little bit more on that. Before we do that, on the BTR side, I think, you also have come up with a very interesting model early on, which is also a little bit different compared to most BTR builders. By most BTR builders, they build the community and then they sell the community once it's leased up. Whereas you may do that too now. I'm not quite sure, but you also have another approach to it where you say, okay, let's build like fourplexes in a BTR environment, and then individual buyers can buy these fourplexes that are still managed by a single management company, right?
That's right. I wanted to democratize large class A BTR because I feel like multifamily is a very mature market. There's really not a lot of juice there. BTR is a very new market. It's in the first inning or the second inning. The next 10 years are going to be great for it. $75 billion have been raised already in the last 24 months to be invested here. And that's unleveraged $75 billion. So that ends up being, you know, $250 billion or more when you leverage it at 70%. That's a huge amount of money floating around. That money is already raised. Most of those people do not do what we do in terms of, you know, working with builders and, you know, kind of, you know, going through the city and going through the headache of zoning unzoned properties. So we have an incredible advantage there compared to this money. But, you know, when we look at it, we still want to have more than one, you know, action plan, because this big money is very fickle. It's there one day and then something bad happens and it disappears. So what I do is that I, you know, build 200 unit communities with 50 fourplexes, right? So these are 50 freestanding buildings, and I pre-sell the buildings to my investors. So they put down 20% for it. And I use that money to basically do my financing. So my profits for my rest of my investors are higher. So instead of raising $25 million of equity, I'll raise 12, and then I'll use $12 million of pre-sale money to do this. I am the only one in the US that does this. And then, so firstly, the profits for my other investors go up, right? And the properties are already pre-sold, but I still have a clause in there allowing me to buy those properties back from the buyers by giving them a certain amount of profit should the market remain low cap. So for example, 2 years from now, I'm finishing a property. If it's a 3.5 cap at that point, right now it's under 3 cap, though I'm sure that will change in the coming months. But you know, if I can sell a institutional property with 3.5 cap, then I can buy those fourplexes back from my investors, give them lots of profit. So they didn't even ever have to manage any property. They just made a bunch of money. And I still make more money because, you know, at 3.5 cap is what I'm selling it at. So I've got an amazing insurance policy. if, you know, things don't go well with the institutionals, I've got these buyers, you know, the property is cash flowing, so the buyers are happy. So, you know, it's certainly a unique program. No one in the US has ever thought of it, you know, but remember, I'm mad. So it's my job to create mad programs.
Yeah, absolutely. Right. And obviously, the yield for these investors in the final product is not as high as for your investors that help you to build these communities in the first place.
No doubt. No doubt. Syndication investors will make more. But I'm going to correct you on that. So in a 20-year time frame, ownership of a fourplex will beat any syndication investor because of the fact that in that time frame, if you refinance, you know, and pull out your equity, then you're basically at a zero basis and your depreciation is not being pulled back. Today, what's happening is so much property is selling in 2022, so much is already sold in the first 3 or 4 months of the year that depreciation recapture is bothering investors, right? They're all of their depreciation is being recaptured. But when you buy a fourplex, as long as you are a 20-year investor, our numbers show it's more profitable. Is in a 5 to 10-year timeframe, no, the syndication investors make more money, you're right. So it's really about legacy investing.
Yes, sure. No, I completely agree, right? And also as an investor, it's your own property, so you're not dependent on a...
Yeah, and there's no splits, right? We don't take any splits on that property. I mean, that's 100% owned property with 100% splits. We don't charge an asset management fee or anything like that. It's their property. I mean, they can do what they want with it.
Yeah. Yeah. Again, it's just another alternative for investors to look at, right?
But they do both. I mean, the same investors are doing syndication investing with us, which basically we tell them, look, this is cash-based investing in a 3 to 5 year timeframe. You know, your depreciation will get recaptured. And then here, this is legacy investing. If you think you're going to die in 20, 25 years, all of that gain, millions of dollars, is basically not going to be passed on to your heirs. Your kids are going to see a step-up basis. I'm hoping the step-up basis doesn't go away, but you know, they've been talking about it going away for 50 years now, so I'm not sure if it actually goes away. The real estate market would crash if they took the step-up basis away.
Definitely, yeah. All right, very good. So let's go back to what you already alluded to, what has happened over the last 45 days, right? So why don't you give us your view of the world? I have my own, and certainly will pipe in there with my view too. But why don't you start and give us your view of the world, of what has happened over the last 45 days, and what you think the impact is?
Of course, and I'll start with Jan 1st, because it's useful to start with January 1st this year and then look at what happened once the Ukraine war started. So Jan 1st this year, when I was reading all of the new stuff that comes out in January from dozens of different data sources, I think most people felt that the Fed would raise 4 times, some were 5 times, some were 6 times. And everyone's belief was that while inflation was very high, this was transitory. And by Feb, March, April, inflation would start to trend downwards. And they were all right and they were all wrong. So when I look at inflation in early March, or actually in early April, right? So we're recording this at the end of April, in early April, inflation definitely went upwards and it's completely out of control at this point at 8.5%, right? And that's, by the way, the official number. If you go to shadow stats, inflation right now is, you know, 13, 14, 15%. So because we strip some stuff out. Well, if you strip out the impact of oil, which started on February 22 when the war started in Ukraine, if you strip that out, inflation is going down. It is going down. So we did manage to finally get to the point where inflation was you know, at the peak, and there were some signs that it would go down. So we would have been on that path of 4 to 5 interest rate hikes. And those hikes would have happened over a year. So there would have been time for the market to adjust, for spreads to adjust, for DCRs to adjust. Well, when the war started, inflation spiked again because, you know, oil went up. And then we had new disruptions, new supply chain disruptions. Obviously, they were already Asia-based disruptions. Now you had European disruptions to add to that. And as a result of that, you know, instead of inflation dropping to the 6% level in April, inflation spiked upwards to 8.5%. This basically tied the Fed's hands. The Fed's job is to try and raise interest rates as slow as they can so that the economy comes in for a soft landing. What the Fed does when inflation is high or when the economy is overheated is that it's bringing the plane in for a landing. And its job is to basically land the plane, not crash the plane, but it is on a glide slope. And that glide slope, the best glide slope, the one that works the best, is about a quarter point increase every quarter. So you increase by 1% a year and the economy can sustain that and the plane comes in for a nice landing. But today the Fed is basically forced to go at double that speed, right? So they have to basically raise interest rates 8 times in a year, or at least they have to tell people they're raising interest rates 8 times a year. They've only raised it once so far by a quarter point. And I think that in this scenario, they're basically saying, hey, we'll raise another 7, 8, 9 times this year. So now they're basically forced to crash land the plane, which is very dangerous because there is no evidence that the Fed actually ever does this well, right? Because the Fed is guessing. And because interest rates actually, you know, when you raise interest rates, it takes 3 to 6 months for their effect to wind into the US economy, you're predicting the future. The Fed is actually predicting the future without any data. They're guessing. They're saying, okay, I'm going to basically give Anton a bulletproof vest, and Anton is the US economy, and I'm going to shoot Anton 6 times, and I'm hoping that Anton doesn't die, right? That's essentially what the Fed is doing. And they don't like to shoot this many times, but they have no choice today because of the war. So everything really changed on February 22nd. We had a chance for a soft landing to real estate, to interest rates, and we lost that chance. We lost that ability. Today, the Fed basically has to publicly talk about the worst case scenario. And as a result, look at what's happened to the market. On January 1st, the 30-year fixed mortgage for single family was 3.11. Today, it's 5.2 as of this morning, right? So April 26th, it's 5.2. So that's a 2.1% increase on the single family side, right? And that's nuts because you usually get that kind of an increase in a year. Sometimes you get it in a year and a half, right? But you never get it in 3.5 months. And so as a result of that, the multifamily market is like, ooh, what the heck are we doing, right? This stuff is crazy. These people are clearly predicting the worst case. We should do the worst case. So now we have a triple whammy. Number one, rates are going up on the multifamily side. Number two, lenders are increasing spreads. They're not decreasing spreads to kind of, you know, to adjust and help. They're actually increasing spreads. And third, they're reducing DCRs. So now you're getting hit 3 different times if you're in contract on a property. Luckily, I'm not. The only property I'm in contract on is a new construction loan, and new construction loans are tied to LIBOR. LIBOR's only changed by 0.25. So I just closed a new construction loan at 4%. It is recourse, by the way. So that's something that I'm, you know, on the hook for. But I'm still okay because LIBOR really hasn't moved much, right? SOFR hasn't moved much. It will. It's only a matter of time. The Fed's going to raise interest rates twice in May, so that they're going to raise by 0.5 point. And that's really when I'm curious to see what happens. I mean, does the economy hiccup? Does the stock market hiccup? Because now it becomes real when LIBOR and SOFR move, where right now it's all speculation about future interest rate increases. And so, you know, the mortgage rates go up because of that. So I think that a significant portion of commercial real estate in contract today is going to fall through. And it has to, because the market changed so radically that any underwriting that was written in January, any offer that was made in February, no longer works.
Yeah, it's only a tough environment. Not many deal sponsors are really openly talking about it for obvious reasons, right? They always want to show the best side of everything that you're doing, which makes sense from a deal sponsor perspective. I think I'm not sure whether that many deals are going to fall through, but they are certainly, and we already have seen it, or they're getting retraded, as we call it on the
fine. Retrading is good, right? So if they can get retraded, that's good.
Yes. Now, I think from our perspective, right, from a financing side, what is really interesting to watch is, right, you mentioned the 30-year mortgage on the residential side having moved up by 2% roughly to the 5.2% mark as of this morning. On the multifamily, when we look at Fannie and Freddie as kind of the standard of fixed rate,
yeah,
10-year, 30-year amortization non-recourse loans, which are the bread and butter in a way for fixed rate permanent mortgages, they were at 3.5% a few months ago, and now we are, even when you get all the affordability discounts and all that, you're at the 4.5, 4.6 at best. Many of these deals are priced somewhere at the 4.7 to 5%. So not as bad maybe as on the single family side, but still...
Not as bad, yeah.
Right, still very significant. But what is really interesting when you look at the bridge loans that are still being done, right, most of them, they use a stabilized debt yield in year three. And when you look at that stabilized debt yield that some of the lenders were willing to go with, some of them in the markets, you mentioned Austin earlier, at extremely low levels, like 6.25, 6.5, which really translates to a fixed rate equivalent loan that would support that is in the low threes, right?
Yep.
Compared to where we are today at least 4.5%. So we already see plenty of bridge loans that if they had to refinance at the pro forma, projected pro forma that the sponsor says we are going to perform at that pro forma, they still would not be able to get out of that bridge loan because the interest rate on the fixed rate loan is just too high. Right? So this is the interesting element where...
That's right, yeah.
Where we feel that bridge lenders also have been almost kind of asleep for the first month or so when we went into that situation, and now they have started to pick up on that picture over the last 20-30 days or so, and we certainly have seen there a very significant change in their attitude, meaning that the debt yields go up or the DSCRs, whatever you want to use on the stabilized side. But the reality is that that has an impact on whatever someone quoted maybe a month ago. It's very unlikely that you're still able and willing to do it today for the same terms, because most of them, as you know, Neil, they are not balance sheet lenders. They finance it with other people's money too. So they... Right. Initially, they're funded maybe through a credit facility, which is fine, but then they need to securitize it into a CLO. And these investors see where the market is, and they do not accept anymore these rates and spreads at the levels that they originally quoted them.
Yeah, we're seeing that. I mean, our balance sheet lenders who are financing our fourplexes, they've not moved much because it's, you know, that was money that they already had. And so they've gone up a little bit, but it's not much. But the non-balance sheet lenders, the brokers, I think there's just a lot of uncertainty and some panic. I think that there's more panic to come. We'll know more in the coming days, but I had projected at the beginning of the year, I do some podcasts and so people ask me, you know, where do you see cap rates? And I said, the demand is so strong that I see cap rates remaining where they are for most of this year and then rising in Q4, because that's when we would have had enough of these hikes. Well, obviously that turned out to be wrong because of the Ukraine war, right? The war just completely changed the scenarios, because inflation, instead of going downwards, went upwards, tying the Fed's hands. So, you know, I think that everyone that was talking, I mean, Marcus and Millichap, Berkadia, everyone was saying, look, we don't see much of an impact in cap rates. Well, they're all obviously at this point wrong. I think that retrading essentially means a change in cap rates. And I think that between a 0.25 and a 0.5 change in cap rates for the deals that are happening in Q2, could be the case. Now, I wouldn't say that it may stay that way. So keep in mind that I am now reading articles from economists. I don't like to read articles from, you know, Berkadia and Marcus and Millichap, because they've got an axe to grind. Mm-hmm. But economists are saying the market is almost overreacting to what the Fed needs to do and is not. So they're taking the worst case scenario of 10 interest rate hikes to price loans. But on the other hand, China's in lockdown, so their growth has decelerated. US growth is slowing. Europe's growth is slowing because of the war. No one is taking into account that the global economy is slowing very rapidly. And so the Fed, I think in a month or so, is going to be in a better position to slow down. Today, they don't have any justification to slow down with inflation being where it is. But as more macroeconomic data comes out at the end of May, beginning of June, I think the Fed will have the ability to go back to quarter point increases. I think half point is locked in for May. There's nothing they can do about it. They need to send an aggressive message. And so anyone like me that has bridge loans, basically our bridge loans are going to go up 0.5%. So we're already, worried about that and making changes to our programs to allow for that. And so I believe today we are in a position where we will have a cap rate change, but I'm not 100% sure if that will stick, because if the market weakens, then lenders are going to become a little more accommodative. They're not going to assume the worst case hike scenario. The Fed will signal it by going back to quarter point increases. And that, I think, a strong economy, we're under 4% unemployment, we can sustain rate increases. I mean, rates increased 9 times between 2015 and 2018. We didn't see any cap rate decompression. Cap rates compressed through 9 increases. Why? Because those 9 increases were over 2.5 years, right? Remember, the Fed likes a glide slope of 4 increases a year. And if you do that, the economy adjusts to that, to a new reality, and things keep moving forward. So I think that it's the extraordinarily rapid nature of what's happened that's the problem.
Yeah.
And all of that is because of the Ukraine war. Pre-war, we didn't see cap rate compression happening until decompression happening until Q4.
Yeah. It definitely has thrown a stick into the wheel for of many predictions,
including mine.
Definitely. So I think a lot of people now talk about the risk for stagflation, right? One could possibly discuss whether we already have some form of a stagflation once you measure it properly. So what's your take on this? Not necessarily right now, because obviously it's very difficult when we are in such a volatile environment, but what do you see over the next year or two, how that risk would ultimately come to fruition or not?
I don't believe that stagflation will occur, simply because I believe that inflation today is simply occurring because of massive supply chain disruptions, because of a war that's going on that has hurt the price of oil. When I look at inflation, the only item that worries me about inflation is food. The world's number one wheat producer is fighting a war with the world's number 5 wheat producer. So I do see food costs remaining elevated into next year. But I think the remaining components will come down. I look at the trucking index, and the trucking index in the last month has fallen to a very low level. This indicates demand is down. It's not public knowledge yet. People are not writing articles about it. But if you look at the trucking index, that's the most real-time way of figuring out, where the demand in the economy is, because that index moves every day, right? And it's based on, the number of contracts locked in the previous day. So it's basically a real-time way of gauging the economy. It's down. So people are going to start talking about weakness in the economy. And when that happens, inflation by itself comes down. Normally, it comes down very quickly. This time, it will take more time because, I mean, China went into lockdown. So the Shanghai's in lockdown, another major city's in lockdown. So the supply chain is going to get disrupted again. So I think stagflation is a possibility. I don't think it's a probability. But the truth is, there's really no way to comment on how long stagflation could occur. Stagflation often occurs for 3 months or 6 months, and it's not a killer if it occurs for short amounts of time. It's when you get stagflation for a year that you're in a very, very bad situation, right? Because you don't have enough economic growth. And on the other side, you've got high inflation. So you're basically, it's a double whammy. Small amount of time, I don't think it's normal to have stagflation for small amounts of time. So we'll see what happens. I mean, how strong does the US economy come out of this weird period by June or July? How quickly does China reopen? They are doing vaccination programs that are different from before. So they've learned something. They tried to basically protect their entire population from this pandemic. I think that was a very bad move on their part, and they're beginning to see that. So there's too many variables. I mean, how much growth does Europe get? How much growth does China get? How much are we hurt by this abrupt halt or slowdown in our real estate market? Are all intangible factors. But I think by July, we'll have a good sense of whether we're headed to stagflation.
Mm-hmm. Very good points. Looking a little bit further out, obviously you are very active in BTR. And when we listen to Ivy Selman, I'm sure you have listened to her many times.
She's a favorite of mine, yes.
So obviously she and her team, they have the view that we are going to have the demographic shift that is going to hit us in a few years from now.
Correct.
And what's your take on this for multifamily as well as BTR? Because obviously some people have the view, look, we are so behind with our construction. There will be many, many years until the supply is actually catching up with the demand. Obviously, Ivy Selman has a very different view. I tend to kind of agree with what she is saying, but I would like also to hear what your take is on that.
So my take is that she is mostly right, but what we've seen is both Ivy Selman and John Burns have not predicted the timeline of demographic shifts correctly. So if you look at, you know, John Burns's famous book, and I look at what his predictions were for 2019, 2021, 22, none of those have really come true. Obviously, COVID was a factor there. But so what I find is that these folks are right, but their timing is often as bad as our timing. So they're, you know, there's because the number of inputs to the US economy is so many that unless you are a supercomputer, you can't really compute which factors are bigger or smaller. In general, I think they're right. So here's what Ivy Selman basically says. So Ivy says, we are an economy that is set up for population growth of roughly 1% or higher. And last year, our population growth in the US was lowest ever. So, you know, lowest for since people have been measuring this stuff at 0.2. And yes, some of that is COVID. So maybe 500,000 of that was COVID. But even if we take that 500,000 out, right? Take that 500,000 out, we grew at maybe 0.3, 0.4%. So we are creating an economy that assumes 1% population growth. And you don't have an economy that does that. There's also demographic trends, you know, people getting older and so on and so forth. And you take a hit from that too. So in my mind, we get a robust real estate economy in 2022, 2023, 2024 is kind of a muddling economy. In 2025 onwards, we really, everyone by then has absorbed the new reality of slow growth. And there is going to be a flight to high growth cities, because what is happening in the US that people are not talking about, and I'm surprised Ivy Selman is not talking enough about it, though John Burns is that we're going to end up with two countries. And there's going to be a country where population growth is 1 to 2%. And, you know, right now that, you know, that changes, but right now it's Texas, Utah, Idaho, Florida, Georgia. And that country, real estate prices work really well. And then we have the rest of the country that goes back to where their real estate cap rates were 20 years ago or 15 years ago. If you look at the Midwest, which has been losing population, you know, their cap rates were 6 cap, 7 cap. Now they're 4 cap, right? So, you know, maybe 5 at the most, but they're certainly not, you know, 6 or 7 or 8 cap, which is what they've been at. So there's a problem there that where the lack of population growth in these areas, the lack of quality jobs, well-paying jobs is being hidden by the massive amount of investment that's coming in. So I think that I am a very strong believer that is that the only way to defend me and my investors is to stay in extraordinary population growth markets and extraordinary job growth markets. That is the only defense, even though it's not a complete defense. We will all have problems when we're exiting properties in 2024 or 2025. And we just have to basically do the best that we can. So yeah, I agree with what she's saying. I agree with what John Burns is saying. I'd love to see a new version of the Big Shift book, because I think that the shifts because of COVID are so humongous that I hope John is writing a new book right now. People like me are waiting for it.
Yeah, definitely, right? Because the shift that COVID has created and also the general attitude, right? So ultimately, it's all about what a large segment of the population what they thought was the normal pre-COVID and what they think is normal today, and that all has a big impact on where people are moving, right?
Very much so, right? So obviously, democratization of office workers has just begun. I am predicting that in the next 3 years, we are going to see multiple technology unicorns that will bypass Zoom, which kind of was the key name during the pandemic. We're going to Zoom. There's going to be new technologies that will make working from home even better, even more collaborative, including three-dimensional cameras and, you know, basically smaller 6x6 offices where you have a wrap around. So that way I'm actually in a holographic sort of environment. There's dozens and dozens of companies working on these, including Microsoft with HoloLens and Apple with Glass. And I think that as these technologies come to fruition, we are going to see another jump in people being okay with home-based work. And so I think that the impacts of these things have not been fully met yet, right? So only a couple million people have moved, states so far, but the prediction is that roughly 22 million people have the ability to move now and, you know, keep their job or keep the kind of, you know, income that they have. So I think that we're only at the beginning of this demographic shift, and I'd love to see what John Burns has to say about that.
Yeah, definitely. Great point. So Neil, this was absolutely fantastic, right? Always love hearing what you have to say and your look into the future. So look forward to see how things evolve and where you are going and where your BTRs are going. So how can our listeners reach you the easiest?
Well, I think the best way is, luckily I'm the only Neil Bawa on the World Wide Web. So N-E-A-L space B-A-W-A, hit that into Google. If you want something specific that I'm, you know, that I talked about, just add that to the name, right? And you'll see 100 podcasts. So Neil Bawa BTR, Neil Bawa interest rates, Neil Bawa, you know, virtual assistants, you know, I have an army in the Philippines. So there's lots and lots of interesting topics that I talk about. Or if you're just interested in getting a menu of those, just Neil Bawa podcasts and you'll get about 150. And obviously they're all titled, so you can pick up whatever catches your interest. That's really the best way to get it started with us. If you're interested in long form data-driven webinars, those are at multifamilyu.com, multifamily university. So that's multifamily followed by the letter u.com. We've recorded 4 since the beginning of this year. And the one that we are the most excited about, even though, you know, it's not a good topic, is the next one. It is going to be in the next 10 or 15 days, which is the impact of inflation and interest rates on real estate. So we expect 2,000 people to sign up for that particular webinar because there's a lot of interest right now. We did one for the Ukraine war and had about 2,000 people sign up for that one too. Some of those predictions that we made were too, we predicted bad things, but I think we were too, we weren't aggressive enough, you know, in our predictions. So, you know, it's nice to kind of get a checkpoint when you record these presentations.
Yeah, absolutely. Right. It's always great to listen to your webinars. That's absolutely fantastic. Also, you probably have the most polished graphics that you use for your webinar. So it's actually not just a joy to listen, but also to watch them.
I got through college by doing graphics design for companies in India. So that has been an obsession of mine to always present with high quality graphics.
Yeah, that's great. Obviously also mention for people who have an interest to invest with you, how can they reach you for that?
Well, if you're watching, there's a logo, you know, on the screen behind my head, growcapitus.com. We have about 800 investors currently. You can see all of our, you can see our track record on our website. We can assure you it's pretty high. And then there's different kinds of investments. We offer an astonishing array of investments. We do tiny homes, BTR, multifamily value add, self-storage industrial, and townhomes. So, and we do them in lots of different states. So we also have funds, we have individual projects. You know, we don't believe doing things a certain way. Really, it's all about a buffet for investors and, you know, whatever people are interested in, they go in for that. So check out growcapitus.com. We don't have any open projects at this point in time, but I'm sure we will at some point.
Yeah, sounds good. Once again, thank you very much for coming on, Neil. It was a pleasure to have you on, and you added great value to our listeners. Thank you very much, Neil.
Thanks for having me on, Anton.